we're swimming in the sea of data that we that doesn't have a lot of meaning to us. And if you have that skill to be able to give it meaning, right, that is what people need. That's what leaders need and decision makers need, is persuasive content.
Welcome back to Future Proof, friends. As always, I am your host, Bill Sheridan, and today I want to talk about future skills. These are the things we're going to have to know in order to stay relevant in a changing and complex world. There have been plenty of studies and white papers and research and tons of other resources and reports that recently have tried to nail down the skills that accounting and finance pros are going to need going forward. And you might be asking why. Are those skills that much different than the skills that have gotten us to where we are today? And the answer is an emphatic yes. And here's why. Technology. Okay, that old culprit. Technology is eating away at our profession. AI is increasingly able to do the stuff that we've been spent a lifetime learning how to do. So how do we stay relevant in a world like this? And the answer is this, by learning to do the things machines can't do. That means learning new skills. So what skills are we talking about? Well, report after report after report all point to the same skill sets kind of bubbling up to the surface, right? Things like communication and collaboration and more frequently other things like critical thinking and strategic thinking and just plain old learning how to think differently. And that's where my guest comes in this week. He's Toby Groves. Toby is a social cognitive scientist who researches new thinking approaches to help experts achieve higher order critical thinking. He's passionate for helping people and teams discover new perspectives, to see radically different approaches that will allow them to solve complex problems. In other words, to figure out how to remain relevant in a world that's doing its level best to make accounting and finance pros irrelevant. And Toby likes to focus on one skill in particular, and that's critical thinking. The question in my mind then is what exactly is critical thinking? And more importantly, how do we get better at it? So Toby and I talked about all of that in this extensive conversation. We'll get to that in a moment. First, here's what caught my eye this week. It's actually the same thing that caught my eye last week. It's the World Economic Forum's annual Future of Jobs report. So this report is important, I think, for a couple of reasons. First, it gets beyond the whole robots are going to steal my job fear-mongering and points out something that not a lot of folks are talking about, and that's this. New technologies are going to create more jobs than they destroy. In fact, a lot more jobs. So the report estimates that by 2022, and that's less than 4 years away, folks, by 2022, emerging new jobs will outnumber displaced old jobs by almost 2 to 1. So there's that. And then the other reason this report is important, I think, is because it's a reaffirmation of sorts that what we've been telling people for a while now, that we're all going to have to learn some brand new skills in order to grow and thrive in the future, that's beginning to look like a hard trend, or what Daniel Burris would call a future fact. According to the World Economic Forum, again, these are the skills we'll need to remain relevant going forward. This is according to the World Economic Forum report. Number one, analytical thinking and innovation. Number two, active learning and learning strategies. Number three, creativity, originality, and initiative. Number four, technology design and programming. Number five, critical thinking and analysis. Number six, complex problem solving. Number seven, leadership and social influence. Number eight, emotional intelligence. Number nine, reasoning, problem solving, and ideation. And number 10, systems analysis and evaluation. In other words, the stuff that machines can't do, or at least they can't do it yet. Now, compare that with research done by Tom Hood. Tom is the executive director of the Maryland Association of CPAs and its learning and innovation affiliate, the Business Learning Institute. And Tom has spent the past few years analyzing and researching studies and thought leadership surrounding the future of the profession. And then he cross-referenced all of that available expertise and research. And he determined that future-ready accounting and finance professionals must be proficient in the following 8 skills. So here we go. Number one, communication. Number two, leadership. Number three, critical thinking and problem solving. Number four, anticipating and serving evolving needs. Number five, synthesizing intelligence to insight. Number 6, integration and collaboration. Number 7, technology acumen and data analytics. And finally, number 8, functional and domain expertise. So there's a lot of crossover there, isn't there, between those two lists? And sitting right in the middle of both of those lists is critical and strategic thinking, the stuff that our guest this week, Toby Groves, has spent his career researching. Critical and strategic thinking, I think these things will impact how good we'll become at most of the other future-ready skills. So if you want to become future-ready, you need to learn what Toby teaches. And what he teaches is this: we must get better at knowing ourselves and knowing those we work with. We've got to get better at thinking strategically and critically, and that means going places we're not typically comfortable going, inward and outward, getting better at knowing ourselves and others. And Toby has some great advice for how we can do that, so let's check it out. Here's how to think more strategically and critically and become a little bit more future-ready in the process, courtesy of Toby Groves. So Toby, thanks for being here today. I guess my first question is, what's happening today that makes this idea of critical thinking and communication so important for us to master?
Yeah, everything is changing so dramatically for us. The type of information that we have to process, people's expectations of us, and literally down to, you know, but what type of critical thinking, how we define it, what we think it is changing because of the way we need to interact with new technologies. So we have more data coming at us faster and from more places, right? Unstructured and structured information. And we're having trouble now trying to figure out what's reliable, what's valid, and we have to figure it out more quickly. So there's this process that has changed so much. It's not like any time in history. It changes the way that we plan, right? Because we know that things are going to change. We can't plan our procedures out for a full year in advance because we're going to have to be able to adapt when things change. So we have to be very careful that we don't box ourselves in by making our setting the procedures, putting everything in place, putting people in places. And then once we get a few months down the line, we might have to change, you know, what people are doing, the procedures and everything. So we have to be much more adaptable than ever in the past. And that requires us being able to be able to have 3 or 4 options, not just 2, and pushing a little more power to the edges where people, the edges of the organization, where people are really seeing what needs to be done and where and how. So it's changed the way we have to communicate, because when we have so many specializations, if we're going to make a good group decision, we need more than one person just having the big picture. We need several people that understand a lot of what everybody does, not just what they do. Mm-hmm. So it's changing decisions. And while we're on that subject of decisions and communication, the big key to that, I believe, is understanding how to interact with these new cognitive technologies. So we have to understand what algorithms are good at and what people are good at, and those things are different. Mm-hmm. So algorithms make different errors and have different strengths, and human judgment makes different errors and has different strengths. And once we understand those, we can leverage those against each other to make better decisions.
Yeah. Yeah, and I want to talk about some of those technologies here in just a few minutes, because I think that's a really interesting area. Well, the point you brought up about being able to, you know, kind of be a little bit more flexible and go with the flow, it reminds me a little bit of
this notion of strategic planning, right? Of you get folks who are trying to formulate a five-year plan, and those five-year plans just don't fly anymore, because who can plan 5 years into the future now? Things just change so rapidly that the plans like that tend to be obsolete, you know, 6 months down the road, and that requires the ability to kind of think a little bit more quickly and cognitively and flexibly, because you know those plans just don't apply anymore.
Right, and you know what the research is showing is that you know you can have a goal, just the steps that you use to get there, all those procedures need to be a lot more flexible, so that your journey on the way to that goal just needs to be a lot more flexible, even though you might keep the same end goal in mind. Over time, that might change too, right? But yeah, certainly 5 years, I mean, it's hard to plan out a year now, right? To know that everything's going to be the same, but it's not. It's not.
Yep. So this focus on critical thinking, communication, it's not just theory or conjecture at this point, right? I mean, there's been a lot of research to back this up, right? I mean, what's science telling us about the importance of these skills?
Yeah, there's a lot of really solid research that I want to get out into the industry, because a lot of that research it gets published in certain journals, and most of the industry, where you know the people that are working on the front lines where the rubber hits the road, is they're not seeing this research, and it's wonderful research. It's telling us that the psychology behind critical thinking now is changing, right? And the way that we see communication, if we're going to talk about, let's say, something like brainstorming, right? The research has shown that the way we used to think of brainstorming is throw everybody in a room, start coming up with ideas, that's the best way to do it. We found that that is absolutely not the best way to do it, because of psychological realities with human beings, right? When you put them in a room, people are going to narrow their thinking, right? They're going to be a little bit conservative about throwing ideas out there. So they found that if they use technology and have people in different areas, not different places, not in the same physical space, entering information, you know, kind of like a text string, and everybody sees the ideas, but they don't know who is entering those, dramatically different results in brainstorming. So those are the types of things, you know, the concept that having everybody in the same room isn't as good as actually having all of those same individuals in separate areas and using the technology to connect them. You have higher quality ideas, and many more creative ideas come to light under that circumstance. And then that type of psychology affects just about everything that we're doing right now. And there's research in every little nook and cranny of critical thinking and communication in our industry that can help us. We just need to understand it better.
So based on what you're seeing with all of this research backing up this idea of critical thinking being important, what do you think are some key first steps that we should be taking to become better at critical thinking?
Yeah, I think one that I've noticed, and it's really simple, it's really basic, but it's all that makes it also a little more difficult, is that the growth mindset versus a fixed mindset. So a lot of these types of things are deep set biases in the way we process information, the way we learn, and how stuck we are to our assumptions. So if you're a fixed mindset person, you believe people's abilities don't really change, right? So if you don't think your abilities change, you're more likely to avoid hard challenges, because if you make a mistake, it's not just something you can learn from. it's an indictment of who you are as a person. So you're going to avoid that. A growth mindset person is going to realize that they're willing to neck out things, you know, and that's where people and organizations really learn is if they can get into that mindset that the culture within that group, regardless of size, is not one where they are battling each other or competing against each other, but part of a team where constructive criticism, you seek it. You almost seek to be wrong because you know you're getting another step further in your understanding of things. That basic difference, I think, is at the root of being open enough to be a good critical thinker, because you're going to have to accept that some of your basic assumptions are wrong. And to a lot of people, their assumptions are tied, they're tied to them emotionally, right? It's a threat if their assumptions aren't met. And that's, then you're perceiving everything down this journey, that this track of bending everything, kind of forcing things to meet your assumptions. And we're really good at that. You know, which is a bad thing to do, but we're really good at it, you know, kind of creating an illusion of reality for ourselves.
I think we all do that more than we think we do. And so what I'm hearing from you is that first step is just to realize that, come to a realization that we're making these assumptions and the impact that has, and just to think differently about how we go about these things.
And the assumptions, I think, is a core part of it. To kind of ferret out what our assumptions are, I teach a three-tier type of trying to search your assumptions, like on a logical level, which is kind of an objective search of, you know, do other people, are you starting from the same set of facts?
Right.
Then you go down to kind of a tier two, and in tier two, those kind of these pre-conscious things that if somebody brings it up to you, you realize it, but otherwise you might not think of it. That's why it's really good to have somebody else that you trust that will talk to you about what your assumptions might be without it being a threat. Because as soon as it's a threat, you know, we've really got a problem. Oh. So one part of this tier two assumptions would be what sources of information you trust, right? Mm-hmm. And people tend, and you see this in all over the world today, people kind of go their separate ways on even what sources of information they trust. And we are really biased towards accepting the sources of information that tell us what we want. And that's not good critical thinking. And then the third and deepest part of this, the tier of searching for these assumptions would be values-based assumptions. And those are a source of some of our mistakes because they're so deep, we don't even see them there, right? Somebody else has to kind of talk to us about why we're looking at things certain ways. Mm. But I could see those as a threat of some of our biggest errors in judgment are things that are values-based, and that might be something that I used as an example recently. I did some research on profiling, and profilers that have made errors based on availability bias. You know, when it came to Richard Jewell, I don't know if you remember this, but Richard Jewell was looked at as the Centennial Park bombing back during the Atlanta Olympics. Mm-hmm. And they were looking at him but nobody knew kind of what was behind the story, that the agents that started really looking hard at him had recalled a recent case, or at least it was recent back then, of a volunteer firefighter in California that had set fires so he could put them out and be a hero.
Mm-hmm.
And those agents, having that the availability of that recollection in their mind, said, you know, gosh, I wonder if Richard Jewell may have, you know, made that call to 911, gone and, you know, told a Georgia Bureau of Investigations, you know, agent, and then started clearing the area, evacuating the area to be a hero. Mm-hmm. And once that was in their minds, they were able to interpret all the evidence after that. That's what his motivation was. That type of journey that we send ourselves down, we create an illusion, and it's invisible to us. I mean, it seems right, and I'm sure that they thought that they were right as they did their work. Another example of like tier three would be, if you remember the Atlanta school cheating scandal, where 178 teachers and administrators in the Atlanta public schools a few years ago were found to have been changing test scores after students took tests on standardized state tests. Mm-hmm. They would alter their answers to help them score better. And it turned out that Mrs. Hall, you know, who was the superintendent of the schools, when I saw her picture, she reminded me of one of my elementary school teachers that I have very fond memories of.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this very deep, right, feeling of, oh my God, you know, I have a little problem thinking that she would be involved in this. Mm-hmm. Right. I would tend to believe her because she looks like my teacher from elementary school that I liked a lot. See, but that's, those are the things you have to ferret out to realize, like, oh, that's bad thinking.
Sure.
You know, that's a bias that you might never find. And we're, our work, everything that we do and perceive and interpret every day when we do our work is full of those types of biases. And sometimes they really affect critical decisions.
Well, sure. And then that's the couple of great examples about how difficult this actually is to do this and do it really well. And we've been telling CPAs that they have to become good storytellers, right? If they want to remain relevant going forward, telling the stories behind the numbers, right? Not just crunching them.
Sure.
So moving on beyond just this notion of critical thinking,
yes,
it's this notion of communication, right? So how do they do that? How do they become better storytellers? How do they become better at clearly communicating complex financial information?
Right. And I think it's important. That's the way I think it helps me. So just like, you know, we could have just now gone through a very logical process of describing, you know, how your biases affect your thinking in three tiers. But then when you give examples of it, right, how much more meaning it has, right? When we talk about the Atlanta school cheating scandal and how, you know, looking at a picture affected my judgment, that's the type of thing that I'm talking about. Is if you're just throwing out concepts, you're hitting the logical part of the brain, but the part that actually interprets what things mean is a different part of the brain. So I'll suggest it this way: the part of the brain that handles counting numbers is not the same as the part of the brain that handles telling you what those numbers mean. Right, mm-hmm. the real interpretation of those. And so what's interesting about this is that the logical part of the brain also handles perceptions and language, but the part of the brain that is handling what things actually mean does not handle language, right? There's no ability for language in that area. So that's why we may have a feeling sometimes or something we can understand things logically, but still there's something bothering us and we can't articulate it because those that part of the brain doesn't process language. Mm-hmm. So that's important, I think, to understand, because I think when I speak around the country to audiences, that's something that they're trying to get through and understand, is that they get to this point where they have trouble explaining or articulating this mismatch in their feelings sometimes, where it logically makes sense, but they are having trouble understanding what to do with the information. Mm-hmm. And it's because you haven't helped somebody attach meaning to it, right? So if you can't tell stories, you're going to have trouble tapping that part of the brain. And the more complex the information is, right? We're flooded with numbers that don't have a lot of meaning unless someone can give us context. So what I would suggest is look at ways that you can give somebody context to the numbers so they can, the part, you know, what really matters, right? To have a real world example to make it tangible, right? To relate it to something maybe similar to what they've experienced in the past. Mm-hmm. How they've used similar types of numbers before, or tell a story about the way somebody else used these, the same type of information, to get to those areas that handle meaning and belief, right? And if you're going to be persuasive, you have to get to those, the believe networks, right? The curiosity networks that tap memories and emotion. The best way to do that, without a doubt, is with stories.
Interesting. So make it personal, in other words.
Right. Absolutely. If the sooner that you can get them to see something from a personal perspective, right, that's persuasive. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you're going to want to know, do a little research, hopefully, and know your audience, that if they've had some really bad experience with whatever it is you're going to be presenting, you need to know that going into it, so that you can address that immediately. And they're going to, of course, that's going to build trust and credibility. And it's very nuanced, right? So it has not only to do with the words that you say, but the way you say them, and that you're open, right? One of the best ways to build trust and openness with somebody is share information, share something, mm-hmm. right? There's that law of reciprocity where they're going to be more likely to share with you. And then you can actually have a conversation about, you know, how they see things, what they believe, and you can update yourself and adjust your presentation as you do that. So, and critically important now, I think probably more than ever, to have the skills to do that, is the computers are going to spit out the numbers, right? We need people to interact with other people, to motivate them, to get them to understand meaning behind the numbers, and why people interpret things in different ways.
And that circles right back to telling those stories and becoming better at telling those stories. Interesting how those things kind of tie together.
Yes.
And you mentioned persuasion, and I want to get to that here in just a second, because that strikes me as something that is going to be an interesting skill to focus in on going forward. I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier, and that's this notion of cognitive technologies. Now, one of our big concerns in this profession is learning how to work with machines so that we won't get replaced by them. And apparently now you're saying that there are some new cognitive technologies that can help us become better critical thinkers and decision makers if we learn how to work with these technologies. So tell me about what some of those technologies are.
Yeah, there are brand new technologies that are actually reading brain activity, right? That help us, that gives us instant feedback about whether we're being effective or not. So in some of my live events, I bring an actual EEG headset on stage, call somebody up from the audience, and the algorithms in my software learn their brain activity when they think certain things. So I've used this in some live settings to actually teach someone, for example, to fly a drone with their thoughts. Now, that might at first seem like, well, what do I do with that? You know, what am I going to do with that in the real world? Well, first of all, think about all the things that you could operate or do with your computer if it understands, you know, what you're thinking. So it might realize, and I think we're to this point very, very soon, we're right on the cusp of it, of the computer being able to realize that here's the path you're going down in your interpretation, but have you thought of this and this and this to try to challenge you, challenge your assumptions. So I think computers are going to get much, much better at that. But also the technology itself, you could use it to check on things, right? If something enters your mind that you want a report, I mean, you'll be able to think about that report and it's going to pop it up on your screen. And that might be handy, you know, when you're talking to someone on the phone and certain reports would pop up that might seem Star Trek-y, but it's really not. We could also fly drones that have cameras to go into areas that are, you know, maybe dangerous, that we would be able to handle security operations. It would have image recognition, face recognition, and be able to do a lot of things, potentially inventory, right? I mean, there are the applications of this technology are endless of what we might be able to do. But I want to repeat, though, as we use these technologies, I think one of the big risks is that we over-rely on the technology, and we must understand it makes errors. It's automatically biased by past numbers or past data. Mm-hmm. And even though they've gotten to the point where they can create random error in the data sets and what those algorithms learn from, it can create kind of some of its own learning data, it's still going to be overwhelmingly based on what has occurred in the past.
That's incredible stuff. And I mean, it's almost as if, you know, these technologies that you're describing are reading our minds, which it's a whole new ballgame at that point.
It is. And a couple of things to think about that is that they might be able to read your mind in one way, but not understand underlying meaning mm-hmm. of things. And that's where, for example, when mm-hmm. so it's hard to talk about algorithms without talking a little bit about what happened at Netflix, because it's so interesting. They had algorithms that were really great at being able to predict what you wanted to watch, and it would suggest it. That was before they switched to streaming. When they switched to streaming, the algorithms that they used failed. They collapsed. They didn't work anymore. And so interesting, because the algorithms didn't understand that shift in meaning, the shift in the prediction. It used to be predicting, like if you were ordering a DVD in the mail, mm-hmm. right? You would be predicting yourself what mood you think you're going to be in this upcoming next weekend, or you might even be, you know, wishful thinking, like here's the mood I hope I'm in, you know, this weekend, mm-hmm. right? But then it changed to streaming, and it's no longer a prediction out. It's what do I feel like as I sit here? And that's totally different, right? You don't even know, you know, that from moment to moment, what mood you're going to be in. So it's, but those, that's what I'm talking about, the shifts in meaning, and how the human brain reacts to that. Algorithms are just not there yet, right? Yeah. They don't understand soft goals. So make sure that you define your soft goals really well. If you, you might realize that you have an algorithm set up and it's going to pursue those goals single-mindedly. But you might notice that's like, wow, the way this is working, it might seem good right now, but this is going to have a long-term damaging effect, right? People are not going to like the way this is actually turning out. So kind of like, yeah, I know Google had algorithms that were, they were using metrics to decide what was successful as far as ads. And so that it was using whatever ads were getting the most clicks, depending on what people searched for. But what ended up happening was that it was putting up the ads that were more clickbait, right? Mm-hmm. So you're having a lower user experience, but the algorithm thinks it's a win. Mm-hmm. When it's not.
Interesting. So still a lot of room for improvement with some of these amazing new technologies. I want to get back to this notion of persuasion real quick. I thought that was a really interesting idea that you brought up here a few minutes ago. So let's talk about persuasion for a little bit. I've seen a lot of articles that list this, the skills that we're going to need to succeed going forward. Very few of these articles, if any, that I've seen, include that notion of persuasion. Why do you think this is such an important skill for CPAs to master?
Yeah, I think it's more important than ever. I think we're going back to this. All of this data is overwhelming, and we still have to figure out, well, what's the most important information? We still have to prioritize, and we're relying on people, right, to tell us that. And when we are trying to read like nonverbals, that interpersonal skill of nonverbals is so important, because when we do brain imaging research, we see that when people are face to face with somebody, their brain is streaming right along, understanding and interpreting, you know, how much they trust the information, whether they think it's reliable, and how confident the whoever's presenting the information really seems. When that is gone, if you're just getting information from a computer, or you're getting information, you know, via email or something like that, your brain is working overtime to try to interpret those missing modes of communication, and people get more confused. They're a little more unsure about reality of what this information means. Mm-hmm. So that's the core of persuasion. And I think that's where, you know, again, stories come in. And, you know, when I talk to leaders around the country, that's probably one of the biggest comments that I get is, I have all this information. I have people feeding me all kinds of data. But what does it really mean? Like, what do I do with it? When do I make a decision on it? I don't know. So that leaves us in the same position kind of that we've always been in, is that we still have to interpret this output and determine what's important, right? We don't want computers determining what's important for us. And to me, this is all part of persuasion, is talking to people about what you think is important, why you think it's important, why they should think it's important. And if you have that passion, you're going to come across persuasively, right? So I think persuasion is important because of it. We're swimming in the sea of data that doesn't have a lot of meaning to us. And if you have that skill to be able to give it meaning, right? That is That is what people need. That's what leaders need and decision makers need, is persuasive content.
So if there was one thing that we could do tomorrow to make ourselves more persuasive, better storytellers, better communicators, one key first step, what do you think it would be?
I think it would be to understand your audience in a more personal way. When I travel and work with groups around the country, I see a lot of lack of time, which leads to a lack of interest. We're in a very regulatory environment, and what I see is a lot of people concerned about following their checklist. That narrows your thinking, right? You want to make sure that you do what's right so you don't have any problems. And it leaves you less time. We only have so much attention that we have. It leaves us less time to have empathy, to pay attention to what other people might either expect, want to hear, not want to hear. And that changes the way we address things. So I think really working hard, take that extra moment and do a little research on your audience to truly understand them. And you're sitting across from them, right? Have a little bit of time to kind of set that baseline, mm-hmm. understand what they're like, understand what motivates them, understand what the world looks like through their eyes. And then that's going to tell you down to what words are to use or not use when you're communicating with them, if you just pay attention to that. And of course, I have to say it also starts with, you know, understanding yourself, being able to challenge your deepest assumptions and not have that be a threat to you will allow you a starting point to do all of these things, be better communicators, to be better critical thinkers. I think that these are the skills of the future for CPAs.
Yeah, imagine that, this age of technological advancement and automation, that one of the key skills that we're really going to need going forward is just this idea of being more human and understanding one another on a much deeper level. Really interesting.
Yes.
Well, Toby, thank you so much for those insights. Just critically important skills that we're going to need going forward. And I really appreciate you taking the time here and offering a little bit of a deeper dive into what it's going to take to get there. So thanks for being here.
Yeah, sure, Bill. Thanks so much for having me.
That was Toby Groves, a social cognitive scientist who researches new thinking approaches to help experts achieve higher order critical thinking, one of the future-ready skills we're all going to have to learn if we want to remain relevant going forward. You can find out more at tobygroves.com, and you can hear Toby live and in person at the MACPA's 33rd Annual Personal Financial Planning Conference. That's scheduled for October 23rd at the Sheraton Baltimore North Hotel in Towson, Maryland. Toby will offer an opening keynote on interacting with cognitive technologies, advanced critical thinking, and communication for CPAs. Sounds like some good stuff, some important stuff to know. You can get complete details and register at macpa.org/PFP.